You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 26, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jeff Madrick, senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and the Schwartz Center for Economic Analysis at the New School, on why economists cling to discredited ideas. And I would add ideas which F you up. Also on the program today, I added it because he's too polite to. Also on the program today, U.S. now involved in two air wars, air battles. U.S. is bombing Tikrit in support of basically Iran and Iraqi forces. Saudi Arabia is attacking Yemen with the support of other Arab nations. Of course, we are also announced yesterday that there will be multiple more FUs in Afghanistan. And, of course,
freedom too serious, forced to leave. Don't you know that all this means Bush was right. All over the Middle East, dictators walk with shaking knees. Don't know what they're gonna do, their worst nightmare is coming true. They fear the domino effect, they're all wondering who's next. Bush was right.
All right, sorry, that was, I couldn't help myself. Yesterday we got sucked down a vortex of early aughts pro-right-wing country music and pop hits, and so I couldn't help myself. We stumbled across that one from back in 2006. That was all a function of the fact that 9/11 made Ted Cruz become, I guess, infatuated with country music.
See, this is what you're missing if you're not a member.
That's right, and sometimes we even get it right. I blew it that time. Also, I should say, later in the program, I'm anticipating a phone call from a New York City teacher whose letter to Andrew Cuomo, or about an open letter about Andrew Cuomo and the testing regime, which, of course, is relevant, I think, for many of us around the country who are going to be dealing with this, was reposted in the Washington Post yesterday. Also, a not terribly substantive, although maybe in many respects telling, story about Rahm Emanuel and his electioneering in Chicago. Bo Bergdahl, you recall that U.S. military personnel who was traded for five Taliban prisoners in a prisoner swap, about a year ago, has now been formally charged with desertion by the U.S. military. More information about the torture he was subjected to after he was picked up after his desertion has been offered by his attorney. And lastly, we will, of course, talk about Tucker Carlson and his brother.
That's just disgusting.
It is. Apparently there was an exchange regarding a Bill de Blasio aide responding to a Daily Caller piece. And we'll play the exchange. We'll read you the emails. And but Tucker Carlson's brother there's been moments in my life where you've experienced, like, you're with some guy and he says something that is just, like, sort of just beyond offensive. And particularly, like, you don't know me. Like, well, how could you say something like this nakedly racist or this nakedly misogynist? And I suppose Tucker Carlson's brother felt, you know, perfectly comfortable with his brother, you know. But I still the amount of anger you must have towards women in general to write what this guy wrote, I think it's just crazy.
When you find out his name, sorry to interrupt, but when you find out his name,
All will make sense.
So just hang in there.
Yes.
And all will be revealed.
We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jeff Madrick. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative at the Century Foundation, Jeff Madrick. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jeff, your piece in The Prospect, Why Economists Cling to Discredited Ideas, which, of course, is... you also outlined in your book last fall, which I should say we're linking to at majority.fm. Let's talk about these seven discredited ideas. These primary ones that you write led us to both the 2008 financial crisis and. You write, centrally contributed to the nation's subpar performance beginning in the late 1970s, and you're talking largely about...
Yeah, that's important, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the ideas, and then we'll talk about their impact, and then why we still see them.
Well, sure. I boiled them down to seven core ideas. There are lots of subsidiary ideas. The reason I wrote the book was, number one, I mean, you want to know why economists didn't have much of an inkling of what was to come. Now, economists are no good at forecasting, and we really even shouldn't hold their feet to the fire on that. But this was really a whopper to miss. But number two, they thought they had the economy under control just before it collapsed. They were boasting about it. They talked about something called the Great Moderation, lack of a great deal of stability in the economy up to that point. And three, as you say, and you reiterate what I say, their very ideas led to the financial crisis in many respects, led to deregulation, for example, led to over-optimism about what finance could do and so forth. And fourth, it's continuing. The same policies are continuing. The Fed is dealing with it right now, a silly idea that we have to control inflation, keep inflation from rising above 2%. So I boiled it down to seven ideas. That's a preface, and I could go quickly into the seven.
Yeah,
but the main one is the invisible hand, one we all learn if we took any economic courses, one we assume is totally correct. And, you know, once you know it, it just absorbs you. It's so compelling. But it really doesn't apply in the real world. It applies very minimally. And it's a kind of utopia that economists believe in. It's a utopia every bit as wide-eyed, frankly, this is a heresy, as Marxian utopias.
So I mean, tell us specifically in terms of the invisible hand. Now, you say, you write that mainstream economists don't say they don't literally believe in the invisible hand. They concede that there are certain assumptions you have to have. What are those assumptions? And talk about how, you know, having to adopt those assumptions, you might as well also adopt the assumption that there's a unicorn that will also make it all work out well.
Right. One assumption is that people all have a lot of information about these markets and understand what these products are. We don't understand what insurance products are. We don't really even fully understand what the car is that we're buying and all the options and so forth. Another assumption is people really know what they want and what's in their best interest. Well, something called behavioral economics, which is really psychology and hardly has to do with economics, suggests we're bad at assessing risk. You know, we're bad at making decisions. The invisible hand depends on that. The invisible hand depends on a relatively free, power-free marketplace where companies can't push workers around or can't push consumers around through distribution or advertising. You know, just today there was an article in the paper about how the airline industry is now basically an oligopoly of four powerful companies that can push markets around. All those assumptions undermine free market invisible hand. And what do we have left? Not much. And yet the assumption usually for among economists is everything is working fine except for a few of these issues. And the final thing, of course, is the invisible hand specifically notes that it doesn't work for building roads, for public education, for even, in my view, Social Security, though centrist and right-wing economists argue otherwise. So the assumptions are enormous. And when economists put it in their first-year textbooks, they don't tell the kids all the assumptions that are necessary for this to work. It's a highly idealized state that really basically doesn't exist in the real world. And we've got to begin by recognizing that and dealing, you know, dealing on a individual market basis with that.
I just want to also just expand a little bit on that last point about it not the invisible hand would not address things like highways or postal delivery, for instance, right? Because when we think
that's
of postal,
my view,
we think of postal delivery. We want to be able to deliver a letter to that guy who lives way out on route, you know, 1A deep in rural America, as it were, as easy as it is to get it in the city. And that's just no one's going to get into that business of delivering to that guy for 44 cents a stamp.
Right.
All right. So,
not for 44 cents a stamp. There is FedEx now, you know, but it's a lot more expensive than 44 cents, as we know. And there are alternatives, private alternatives, but they're much more expensive. So we've had a subsidized post office since basically the beginning of time. And it's had a great deal of many benefits for America. But it's not only that. We built canals. We built the railroads through government subsidies. We built health. We sanitize the water. People forget about this. There's, you know, General Motors or U.S. Steel did not sanitize the water through the free market. Local governments did. In New York City, where I live, New York State was one of the first to sanitize, which contributed enormously to the growth of the city, because before that, we had plagues, great disease-ridden plagues that wiped out populations or certainly undermined population growth. Mainstream economics allows for what are called these public goods. It allows for the fact that free markets don't work. But what they tend to do is to minimize free markets don't work in terms of these public goods, like education, like roads and bridges and so forth. But what they do is minimize the extent to which they don't work. You know, in my view, there are no free markets virtually in America anymore, big markets where there isn't too much power on the part of business to set prices and control innovation and dampen innovation. And there are many, many areas of public goods that are just not, that the free market is, even mainstream economists admit, is not appropriate, not workable.
Your next idea is this notion that people get what they deserve.
Yeah, that's part of the free market idea, that workers get what they contribute to the economy. That means the invisible hand works in the labor market. Everybody, it's just like goods or services, or everybody gets paid what they deserve. Laborers get their wage. That's the price of labor. And business pays as much as necessary to get their services. Well, it just ain't true. And that's because economists tend to believe that. They tend to believe raising a minimum wage, a government set minimum wage, loses jobs, again, based on the invisible hand. There's lots of empirical evidence that suggests that is not true, or hardly true, or marginally true. And yet, you know, the invisible hand suggests it should be. That's why we had unions in the first place. People were not getting paid what they deserved. You know, that banner, the unions brought you the weekend. Well, it's true. The business wasn't going to give you the weekend based on some pressure from the invisible hand. There have been times in our history when the invisible hand did work to some degree. I shouldn't say the invisible hand. We did have higher wages because we had fewer people. But we're not than Europe did, fewer potential workers. But probably wages didn't rise rapidly enough. So that falls in the category of an invisible hand failure, but a damaging one because many of us get underpaid.
And tell us about who John Baptiste Say was and Say's law.
Well, there's an idea around 1800 or so that if you make it, people will buy it. There'll be enough money around for wages and investment of profits and so forth that people will have enough income to buy your product. Now, Henry Ford knew better in the classic example where he said, it just ain't so. I got to pay my workers pretty darn well, up to $5 a day, so they can afford to buy my cars. Keynes hated this idea of J.B. Say, a French economist who himself more or less renounced it eventually. But it's the centerpiece for believing economies adjust themselves with no intervention by government. That is, if savings go up, business will invest and the economy will roar again. What do you do when you have recession and incomes shrink and unemployment goes up? According to that formulation, save more so that business has more to invest and investment will kick in and be the engine of the economy. John Maynard Keynes says it just doesn't work that way. If you save more, there'll be less demand. The business won't want to invest because nobody's buying their products. And that's a central flaw. But it's a central flaw that's still widely believed. And some of my mainstream economist friends say, no, economists don't really believe that anymore. And I have arguments with them all the time. Many economists were for fiscal stimulus, on average, were for the Obama stimulus, $800 billion. The majority were even, according to surveys, for a second stimulus, which Obama did not implement or propose. But before that, Say's Law, by and large, dominated all kinds of fears of budget deficits result from a belief in Say's Law. The budget deficit reduces the national savings in the economy. The Federal Reserve, the federal government is spending money that it doesn't have, it has to borrow, and crowds out private investment. Well, this is an exaggerated idea. Maybe occasionally it works when the economy is running hot as heck, but the economy has rarely run hot as heck except in the late 1990s, in the last 40 years anyway. So Say's Law is pretty important and a pretty bad idea.
The biggest piece of evidence of the fallacy of this of Say's Law would be the $2 trillion some odd dollars of cash that corporations
very
are basically
point.
Just hanging on to.
It's a very good point, Sam. They're loaded with cash. Why aren't they investing? Because Say's Law really doesn't work. You need more demand for goods and services. And then they will find reason to invest and maybe invest more liberally in brand new ideas, not just high tech digitalization ideas. And that's the economy we now have. So it's a pretty dangerous idea.
And you make the point that even Democratic economists supposedly would be providing a sort of a leftier perspective on these things, we're championing these ideas under Reagan, under Clinton.
Right.
I would imagine to a certain extent there were people in the Obama White House as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, using the Say's Law idea that you crowd out private investment. Deficits will undermine national savings, and therefore it'll crowd out private investment. And it's certainly not the case in recessions and weak economies, but Democratic economists were arguing it all the time. And in fact, even some, or at least some well-trained mainstream economists, were arguing that Britain and Europe should continue their austerity policies. Austerity economics comes out of Say's Law. What do you do when you have a weak economy? You save more. How do you save more? Cut government spending, cut government deficits, raise taxes. Well, that's what Britain did. That's what Europe did. You see the mess Europe's in. Britain is still really in a mess. They're finally starting to grow, but after years of pain and fall and very bad productivity, output per hour of work, which is the heart of a strong economy. So austerity failed there, and their wages haven't risen. They don't have a high unemployment rate, which they brag about, and the British government, Cameron and Osborne brag about. The wages haven't gone up. Well, that's a pretty serious strike against that policy.
Those austerity policies, sometimes strike me as just sort of like some type of mass psychological problem. Feel like I've done something bad and I need to be punished.
Absolutely. You think about it. Every religion has an aspect of that, right? We all, the Jewish religion, the Catholic religion, Protestants, Muslims, there's always an aspect of sacrifice. And if you sacrifice and if you suffer, you will be better. Now, I'm not saying that's not appropriate in religions. I've been brought up in a religion where some of that is true. But there is a human tendency to believe that if you sacrifice, you're doing good. But it doesn't apply to modern economies. And yet it's easy to convince people that it's the case. There's a lot of support for austerity economics in Europe. And we have austerity economics, too. It goes by the name of sequestration, cut the budget deficit.
It also seems sort of bound up in this idea, too, that if something is failing, then it is sort of morally problematic in and of itself and therefore needs. So it's not just that the sacrifice helps you attain a better place, but that it is your attempt to cleanse yourself in some way, to redeem yourself.
It's a catharsis. and it's often not applicable to economics or even daily life. You know, pain, no gain. Well, there are other ways to have gains.
Let's talk about inflation targeting and price stability being holy. What does that mean exactly?
Well, an idea was adopted, and I always worry that, you know, I wrote a book about all this. So as you well know, Sam, it's hard to boil it down into a few sentences. Sometimes I just over talk this, but I urge people to look at the book and it'll be clearer. But an idea was adopted in the late 1990s that inflation targeting was the main policy a government had to adopt and the economy would work well. It really was adopted in the 1980s. That is, keep inflation low, and that's almost all you have to worry about. Now, that's based on a free market idea that free markets will take care of themselves as long as you get inflation out of the equation, because inflation confuses buyers and confuses sellers, confuses business. Take inflation out and the market will work well. So people like Ben Bernanke believe let's keep inflation at 2% or lower. New Zealand started it, Canada adopted it, and so forth. In the U.S., we adopted it, and then they proclaimed it was succeeding, the great moderation I talked about earlier, that the economy was doing great. Well, look what happened. This was from the mid-80s until 2007. Look what happened in that period. Well, first of all, it led to the great crash and the current poor economic performance. But secondly, wages stagnated, or most importantly, wages stagnated over that period, especially for males. Or the family income grew very slowly, largely because women went back into the workforce. Spouses kept going into the workforce. That began to end in 2000, and now family incomes are lower than they were in 1999. They grew very slowly from the 1970s to 1999 on average in historical terms. We had one financial crisis after another. 1982, 87, 1990, 1994, 1997, 1998, 2000, and finally 2008. And they're talking about how the economy was doing great. I don't know what world they were living in. And that was by and large attributed to inflation targeting, keeping inflation up. It was the extreme belief in a free market economy and laissez-faire policies, keep government out, except to keep inflation down.
I don't want to jump too far ahead as to why these ideas persist, but I mean, in your give me your sense. I mean, particularly for something like this, where the one thing that I think you know we can really be clear on is that when you control inflation that aggressively, what it definitely does is it maintains the value of the debt that you have extended. So in other words, if you've given credit, if you're a credit card company, you're a bank, all the value of those loans retains itself even more aggressively because the value of there's no inflation and you can't be paid off with less valuable dollars down the road. I mean, how much of something specifically like this is a function of an iron grip around some ideology, and how much of it is we're just going to use the ideology because at the end of the day, coincidentally, I make more money?
Well, you know, a lot of this free market ideology, and not just for creditors, for big banks and wealthy people who make loans, financial institutions who make loans, a lot of this free market ideology tend to benefit vested interests, that is the wealthy and the powerful. I look at Wall Street, it's an obvious case, but you're entirely right. Low inflation tends to benefit creditors, those who make loans. In old-fashioned terms, you could say it benefits capital at the expense of labor, who tends to borrow money. When you borrow money and inflation is low, you're paying it back in valuable dollars. If inflation is reasonable or somewhat high, you're paying it back in less valuable dollars. So it's better for the debtor. Most of us, of course, who have mortgages or car payments and so forth. So you're entirely right. There is a vested interest. There is indeed a conflict of interest, I think, among mainstream economists, because this whole revolution in favor of simple-minded free market economics began in the 70s, when America in general turned more conservative and skeptical of government.
Let's talk about your addressing the idea of more cross-broad border trade is always good. You know, I spoke to Mike Consul yesterday about the free trade and the TPP. Give us your critique of this idea that it's. I think I mentioned Thomas Friedman's quote, and I think I had paraphrased it, but he basically said, "I don't need to read anything beyond free trade, then I know it's good."
Yeah, well, you know, that's the application of the free market principle worldwide, and it's a complex issue. The world. And we're all different, and we are different places in our economies. So the first point to remember is, in the U.S., if we adopt a free trade policy, we let any imports come in, we have to recognize somebody's going to get hurt by that, maybe a lot of people. There may be on net a benefit. I'm not an anti-free trader, but on benefit, there may on net, there be when you net out losses and gains. But some people lose. So every time we adopt a new free trade idea, we should remember we have to improve our social net to protect those who will lose jobs or get lower wages as a consequence of that. That's one thing. Another thing is not all the rules can apply to every country. In the old days, before the end of Bretton Woods, which was roughly the early 1970s, people lauded that period, because there was a huge increase in world trade at that point. But the rules were much looser. Countries were allowed to adopt policies to support certain industries, small industries, to grow, to become more competitive with large industries in big nations. Now that's hard to do. You're not allowed to do that, or you violate world trade WTO restrictions on that kind of thing. So there's an oversimplified idea about free trade. Just free trade alone will help the world grow. And it's not that simple. It may, even on balance, when we analyze it, it may not work on balance because so many countries are deprived of developing their own businesses, and so many people may well be hurt by it. There's one other aspect. The way we develop these restrictions also, again, tends to help the wealthier countries. The U.S. and other wealthy countries tend to have the biggest say in these rules. So we're most worried about protecting our intellectual property.
Right.
We don't want other nations to be able to sue us because we have copyright rules. Now we think we need copyright rules. I think they're a little bit too helpful for business, but I believe in them to some extent. Other nations see that as an unfair trade practice. So it's a much more complicated issue than people think, and this TPP is an example of that.
And we should
and
add,
we don't even know what's in it.
We barely. I mean, there was actually some documents, more documents released today, not necessarily that give us a full picture of this, but to the extent that we have a sense of it, I mean, it doesn't even feel like it's about bringing down tariffs at all. It is more about protecting certain intellectual patent regimes. But let's jump. We're going to leave a couple of those bad ideas.
Yeah, we better, unfortunately, I have to go in 6 or 7 minutes.
Okay, so let's talk about, like, you know, how is it that these ideas still are around, that these ideas have such currency and such a stranglehold over our society, are the way that our economy works?
Well, first of all, I should start at the very beginning. They're compelling in many ways. The oversimplification of the invisible hand is a very compelling idea. People think they understand the economy. That's number one. Number two, it accords with recent rise of conservative economics. Keep government out. Why do mainstream economists adopt that? I think because it is a simple program. It's analyzable. You can build complex quantitative models based on these propositions. The models are complex. The ideas are highly oversimplified. It's like young economists are judged by their methodology, not by how their research really is applied in the real world. I believe they think their models are the real world. It's natural to young people, especially if their mentors imply it is. So this whole foundation of current mainstream economics is given to a set of principles that seem to be easy to understand, to which complex methodologies can be applied to make it feel like you're making progress, to maintain academic standards that really don't have to do with the real world, but have to do with an academic structure and an artificial measure of prestige. And also, they accord with the vested interests we talked about before. Economists get jobs, get grants from these vested interests. If you go to the White House, you're set because you're going to get a great job when you get out of there. If you go to an elite university, you're set because you're going to get a job in the White House. The elites very much dominate the thinking. So I probably have given you a much more general answer than I should, but that's the best I can do at the moment.
Well, that will suffice. People can pick up your book, Seven Bad Ideas, How Mainstream Economists have Damaged America and the World. Jeff Madrick, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Sam, I appreciate it. I should say one other thing if we have a moment. There
Please.
Are studies that suggest that when young people study economics, especially as they go on, they become more politically conservative. I don't mean economically conservative, but literally politically conservative, and which by and large means less government interference and less social policy.
Why do you think that is? Is it simply that as they study economists more, they're just surrounded by more conservatives? Or, I mean, because it's not...
No, I think the ideas themselves suggest that people can make decisions on their own. They don't need help. Well, we don't really need that much unemployment. Unemployment keeps people from seeking jobs. We don't need minimum wages. The general philosophy, which economists deny, they deny there's an ideology or philosophy behind all this. But there is, and it tends to be what many of us think is a conservative ideology, which is social policy should be minimized. Individualism should be accentuated. These theories, these seven ideas I talk about, are very individualistic in nature and deeply ideological. And the economists benefit by believing in it. They've created a structure for themselves that's quite lucrative. I think, in fact, economics professors are the best paid on campus because they bring in a lot of grants and a lot of money, and kids really want to take the courses.
I can't off the top of my head recall who it was that said the hardest thing to do is to convince someone who's I've butchered it, but it's essentially if people are making their money out of ignorance, it's impossible to talk their way out of it. Jeff Madrick,
yeah, well,
thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Sam, thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye bye. Somebody did a ringtone of my Skype impersonation yesterday. The Skype call. Jeff Madrick, we've linked to his book and his piece at majority.fm. Folks, again, let me just take this time to thank you. We are doing so well on our Indiegogo campaign that I am now I am rushing to get our next wave of perks up. That we had planned, assuming that we would need to sort of juice the campaign, but it's been going at an incredibly steady rate. Where are we now? Somewhere around 70%?
Last I checked, we were at 70. You got it up now?
pulling it up right now. Let's see exactly where
80%.
We're at.
80% of our goal after what? Now it's been 9 days?
In 10 days.
10 days.
We have raised $25,915 towards our 32,000 goal at 80% funded.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, folks, so much. Very much appreciated. We're going to head into the fun half now. And we've got the representative, Louis Gohmert.
Louis. He's quite angry.
Very upset about net neutrality.
This is a good clip. I'm just going to say that. I feel like with Louis, the bar is so high that you start to kind of get like, all right, man, you got to do a little bit better than that. You can't just do but it's a good clip. That's all I'll say.
I mean, honestly, how much time do you really think? And maybe this is just sort of some type of like soft bigotry on my part. How much time do you think Louis Gohmert actually has spent thinking about the internet? And
you know,
these questions.
What makes him so funny is I think he spent a lot of time thinking about the internet.
I think he sat down.
So
much money sloshing around right now. Like I said, in those days before the FCC voted to reclassify or re-reclassify, I should say, the internet under Title II, there was, and I had never seen something so naked. I mean, folks know that I listen to right-wing talk radio with more frequency than I probably should. And, you know, I listen to like obscure weekend guys. It's just interesting to me to see who's getting the talking points. And it was just like all of a sudden somebody turned on the spigot. You'd never heard the words net neutrality on right-wing radio until 2 weeks before, where that same Republican commissioner was doing the rounds, which, of course, happens. I mean, when somebody comes out with a book or there's an issue, you know, you get sent around, you get it from public relations. But they all had the same talking point. There was not even the slightest bit of nuance. And none of them even said, like, hey, this is going to bore the heck out of my audience, which does not use the internet. And so
they have no respect for their audience. But I will just say, he's so angry in this clip that I wonder if you're familiar with this show and our theory of who Louis Gohmert really is.
Oh, yeah.
Really,
I guess maybe,
for.
You know,
I wonder if he's actually indirectly genuinely angry because net neutrality throws another plan into jeopardy. That's all I'll say. A plan that might be affecting his real patrons. If that makes sense. The anger is
very
visceral.
That does not make sense to me. But well, I mean, long-time listeners, right? No,
Russian
yes,
angle.
That part I know. Long-time listeners
so
of this program will know.
What if net neutrality threatens a Russian plan that we don't know about that never even occurred to
us?
Oh,
I see. I see. Okay.
See?
I see where you're going with this. Well, for people don't understand what Michael is saying, Louis Gohmert studied in Russia as a college student, and we have a theory here that would explain Louis Gohmert, because a lot of people are like, how is it possible that someone of this acuity could rise to the level of congressperson or even just, you know, tie his shoes every day and get to work on time? And one of the theories that we have floated is that he is, in fact, a deep, deep, deep covered Russian spy. Now, of course, he would have been a Soviet spy, but presumably there's still elements that are controlling him in Russia. So we have speculated on that. That's where the Gomericans came from. All right, we're going to take a break. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Tomorrow on the program, I don't know if we're going to have Andy Kindler, but we will definitely have Guy Lawson, because Cliff is gone on vacation. Spring break, folks. You know when people have kids, they go on spring break.
And that'll be happening around here very shortly. Although we're going to have many people won't even know it that we've gone on break.
I don't think they usually do. We usually give them a lot of content.
Yeah, this week we're going to have at least three or four new interviews. So for you, it's not going to seem like a vacation at all. You're still going to have to show up and do your job. Listen to the podcast. All right, 646-257-3920.
What, I wasn't listening. I'm sorry.
You can become a member at Majority FM. It is your support that makes this show possible, and very, very thankful for it. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Do you buy crap from Amazon? Buy it through our Amazon link at MajorityReportKickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com. Pick up the app. It's free. It's ad-free. Free and ad-free. At MajorityApp.com, iOS, and Android. All right, folks. Be back in just a moment.